I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. What were the founding fathers thinking? That's what Tom Ricks asked himself after the 2016 election that made Donald Trump president of the United States. Rick spent the last four years reading what Washington, Adams, Jefferson, and Madison were reading as they created a new kind of government and later served as the country's first four presidents. They each found inspiration in Greek and Roman philosophers, in the idea of virtue and the common good. But as Ricks writes in his new book, First Principles, they never reconciled the horrors of slavery with the ideals of equality and freedom so central to a democratic government. He quotes Samuel Johnson, who said in 1777, "How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty among the drivers of Negroes?" In his decades as a journalist, Tom Ricks has covered national security and the military. He has won two Pulitzer Prizes for his reporting. He's also the author of several books, The Generals and Fiasco. Tom Ricks, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
You've given us a lot to think about and a lot to talk about, but let's begin with our current president and what the founders were thinking. Did they imagine a president who would praise dictators and autocrats, who would undermine institutions, who would undermine voting, who would refuse to accept the results of an election and would impede the transition to a new president? Was that ever on their radar?
Yes. As James Madison remarked in a memorable aside, "If men were angels, we wouldn't need a government." But another point, after Aaron Burr, a real rat, nearly became president, Thomas Jefferson wrote, "Bad men will sometimes try to get in office and succeed." So they wrote the Constitution very much thinking, we can't count on virtuous people to be in office. What we need to do is, instead of relying on virtue or public spirit, we need to balance people's self-interest. We can't depend that people will do the right thing, but you can depend on people to pursue their interest of them, their families, their region, and so on. So Madison says, okay, let's disperse power across the country between the states and the federal government in three branches of the federal government, between the two different houses in the legislative branch. We won't have members of the legislature serving in positions in the executive's cabinet as they do in parliamentary system in Britain and elsewhere. So it really was an effort to throw power everywhere so that anybody who wanted to make progress would have to find other people who supported them. You would have to have coalitions and alliances, compromises, and even cut deals. And so I think Madison, looking at today, would say, hey, gridlock, that's not a bug. That's a feature. We designed it into the system.
You started reading, or you decided after this 2016 election, and you describe yourself being both shocked and surprised. And I do want to talk about the founders, but let me just ask you a couple of questions about our current president. What was so shocking and so surprising to you about his election 4 years ago?
I simply did not think he would be elected. I actually live in a congressional district in Maine that twice has gone for Trump. I know a lot of people in this district, and I did not think they would vote for Trump, and they did, and they've done so twice. So it made me think I really need to sit down and think about how this happened, why this happened. How could a man like Trump, who I think is a man utterly without empathy, profoundly ignorant of the American system, how could he become president? I think when Trump became president, he thought he'd been elected king. Now, that's not entirely off the mark. Alexander Hamilton, during the Constitution, wanted to have a kind of king. He wanted a president for life and senators for life. He lost that argument, fortunately, but it was one of the things that was in play. I think the interesting thing is Trump has been very unsuccessful when he bumps up against the Constitution. He's been surprised to find out that the Supreme Court, though ideologically sympathetic, does not think it works for him. He was even surprised to find out that Nancy Pelosi didn't work for him as Speaker of the House. Where he has been more successful is in violating norms. All these things that we kind of expected presidents to do, like have decent, peaceful transitions of power to admit when they're defeated, And he violates those norms, which makes me think we may need a new constitutional convention to revisit some of the norms that he has violated and see whether, consider whether they need to be written into law. And while we do that, for example, I think we could revisit some other questions. I really have become a fan of terms for Supreme Court justices. Don't put them in for life, put them in for 14 years or 18 years, and then send them on their way. I think there's a lot of other changes we could make.
And I do want to talk about all those changes because you have a lot of ideas at the end of your book, but I'm also thinking of what Benjamin Franklin said about, you know, we're a republic if we can keep it. Can we keep it? And I know that the founders were concerned about having a large republic, which we are, obviously a lot larger than we were more than 200 years ago. But do you feel confident that we have a republic we can keep?
No, I don't.
No.
I think it's a constant question. It strikes me that George Washington, in his first inaugural address, referred to the United States as an experiment. And strikingly, President Obama, in an interview he did the other day with the editor of The Atlantic, said pretty much the same thing. Obama said that America is an experiment in multi-ethnic, multicultural democracy. And by experiment means the experiment can fail. I'm not even sure we have a clean republic right now. I think we have a more of an oligarchy that is ruled by the rich, but a kind of democratic oligarchy. We have rule by the rich, in which the rich dominate American politics. The dollar is more important than the vote and who gets elected. But it's an oligarchy with democratic trappings, I think.
Well, the founders, most of them, were rich, or certainly they were white men of the elite. Is that so shocking that we favor rich people in this country?
We do favor rich people, I think, more than we used to. I think the Supreme Court has become basically a court representing property interest. I don't think that was the intent. And not all the founders were wealthy men. John Adams, for example, who never owned a slave. I have a lot of problems with John Adams. But to his credit, he never owned a slave. He chopped his own firewood all his life. He worked with his hands all his life. And, by the way, even though he was a bitter one-term president, he did turn over power peacefully to his successor, Thomas Jefferson. Now, being cranky John Adams, he refused to go to the inauguration and instead left town that morning on the 4 a.m. coach to Baltimore. But he was the first president to turn over power to the opposition, and for that we are deeply in his debt.
Go ahead.
The Southerners generally were wealthy, but I don't think the wealth extremes were as great as they are now. James Wilson, one of the more important founders who's not paid attention to, while he was serving on the Supreme Court, also was serving weekends in jail in the debtor's prison and wound up totally wiped out financially at the end of his life and basically died a pauper. So wealth came and went. They weren't usually wealthy, and John Adams said, at one point, he warned, and I have this in the book, he said, we don't want anybody being too wealthy and anybody being too poor. We really want a big middle. And I think while the Constitution was careful to protect property, especially enslaved people as property, I don't think they wanted to see the great extremes of wealth you see now.
As you mentioned, you see us as a democratic oligarchy or oligarchic democracy. And you do say at the end of the book that one of the things we have to do is figure out how to get money out of politics. Would that support this middle that the founders were at least on paper saying that they supported?
I think so. I think that the Supreme Court's done a lot of bizarre things, declaring in the 19th century that black people, even free, had no rights that the white man needed to respect. And then making separate but equal the law of the land late in the 19th century, which meant that basically black citizens, though free, were definitely second-class citizens well into the 20th century, into the point around where I was born. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. Put me back on it.
And I was thinking of the next question I was going to ask you. I think it's sort of, you know, where we stand today, this idea that we can support, a middle class in a way.
I was dragging on the Supreme Court, and I was getting to the point that one of the most bizarre things the Supreme Court has done is say that corporations are people, right. As Mitt Romney famous said, corporations are people, my friend. They are not people. It's a bizarre legal fiction. If you say corporations aren't people, then they don't have the political rights of people, and you can start getting them out of campaign finance, which I think would be a huge step forward for this country.
Well, let's go back a couple of centuries and to the influence of the Greeks, the Romans, the philosophers, the literature on these four men that you write about in your book. Was it unusual at that time to have philosophy of, so many centuries ago to have that kind of influence on not just the elite of the country, but also on everyday people in America or in the colonies?
The elites were immersed in the culture of the ancient world, Greek and Roman history, philosophy. More Rome than Greece, and especially with Rome, the decline of the Roman Republic, that was their core political narrative. That, to them, was instructive in how to go about politics and what to worry about in politics. Now, very few people went to college in those days, but the people who had gone to college, just a handful, a few thousand people, were the people who were the elite who then ran American politics and, to a surprising degree, American culture. So the rest of the country, even though it wasn't educated in Greek and Latin, paid attention to those cultures and histories, knew them through popular plays. One of the most popular plays of the 18th century was Cato, about another key figure in the decline of the Roman Republic. So somebody like George Washington, who was relatively uneducated, picked up a lot of this simply by trying to be one of the elites, paying attention to its culture. His favorite play was Cato, and he really dedicated his life toward trying to have the characteristics of Cato, a prudent, frugal, reserved, strong-willed, but slow-acting person of justice. That's who he wanted to be, and that really was what the public man of the 18th century wanted to be.
And that is Tom Ricks. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. He's got a brand new book. It's called First Principles, What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country. You can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I do want to ask Tom Ricks what the founders would think of Twitter. And you can also call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Marty Moscowen, you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And I'm talking with Tom Ricks. He's a journalist, a military historian, and he's got a new book, First Principles, What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country. He's also a columnist for the New York Times Book Review. You were talking just a bit about George Washington, and I do want to move on to the other three founders that you write about. But the fact that he gave up military command and the presidency really does, I guess, set a model for this country for the rest of history, maybe until today. I'm not sure.
I think it does. Washington, there's a saying among historians, the more you learn about George Washington, the more you admire him. Washington set out to establish norms, to kind of put the flesh on the bones of the Constitution. And it's a wonderful thing, but it's a problem for us now because you have a president now who is entirely ignorant of the norms, doesn't care about them, and has a kind of contempt for them. Washington would have worn a mask, I can tell you.
Would have worn a mask. Okay. Yes.
Washington goes into office wanting to set norms. He is careful as a general to always defer to Congress. When he addresses Congress and actually turns in his commission at the end of the war, his office, his general's commission, he stands before Congress and bows. They do not rise because they occupy the superior position. He wants that to happen that way. He goes home peacefully. Again, after serving two terms as president, he goes home, turns over power. And by the way, little known about Washington, after the presidency, he becomes very interested in abolitionism, getting rid of slavery, and studies pamphlets about how that might happen. He was not an educated man, but a bright man and a careful man, and I think he learned a lot from experience, more than most people do, which may be why he was the only one of the slaveholding founders to really develop some qualms about slavery and try to think about how to get rid of it.
You're right. Washington, as a stiff-necked soldier, Adams, a brilliant, honest, self-absorbed crank, Jefferson, a dreamer of liberty who lived in hypocritical luxury off the sweat of captive humans, Madison already with one foot in the next generation, perhaps more of an American than a Virginian, and an unapologetic politician. Let's talk a bit more about John Adams, this crank that you describe in your book, Tom Ricks.
I think John Adams has had an unfairly inflated reputation in recent years, first because of David McCullough's book, which was really a biography of a lovely marriage. I have a lot of time for Abigail Adams, and I think she gave John Adams a lot of the help and gravity he needed to get as far as he did. But Adams was brilliant. He was honest. But boy, could he really be troublesome. Benjamin Franklin memorably said that he's a good man, he's an honest man, but at times he is absolutely stark raving mad.
Oh, wow.
He was not, I think, a person cut out to be president. It was going to be a difficult act to follow George Washington for anybody. John Adams comes in to office. He believes deeply in stability, surprisingly, for a revolutionary. To have a stable America was really his goal. This is an imitation of Cicero, his Roman role model, who worked hard to preserve the stability of the Roman Republic. And he becomes president, and he hates the fact that people criticize him. There are 150 newspapers in the country, of which about 60 are critical of him. He goes politically after 25 of them, using the justice system to give them trouble, and 12 wind up in jail simply for criticizing the president. This is partly comes out of his reading of Roman history. The founder's reading of Roman history is the Romans lost the Republic to a general. So we got to be careful of the power of generals, like Julius Caesar coming and taking power ultimately. And they got to that pass because of two things, corruption and faction. Now, corruption is money in politics. They would look at our campaign finance system today and say, that is corrupt. That's not what we meant. Hmm. But faction also was a great fear, probably their biggest fear. What we would simply call it partisanship, political parties. But to John Adams, being in a faction was tantamount to treason. And so he starts throwing newspaper editors into jail simply for criticizing him. A newspaper editor in Manhattan criticizes him. Adams wants him indicted. The poor guy gets smallpox and dies. The wife takes over the paper. They're going to indict her. She gets sick. So then they indict the printer of the newspaper. It really is quite vicious. Adams, at his ugliest, celebrates in a letter the fact that a newspaper editor who had been critical of him had died in a fire along with his family.
Wow.
This is pretty rough stuff.
It sure is. You also struggled with Thomas Jefferson, as I think most people do, the hypocrisy sort of built into his life. But you also talk about the influence of the Scottish Enlightenment on him and actually on, I think, James Madison as well. And I think we often think of the British Enlightenment and we give the Scottish Enlightenment short shrift. Can you fix that for us?
Yeah, I think this has actually been a major error by American historians, beginning with Carl Degler in the early 20th century. He says John Locke, English philosopher, is the single most important influence on the founders and their thinking. If you go to a great website, Founders Online, which is the National Archives with help from University of Virginia and others, has put online all the words of the founders, their letters, their diaries, their political pamphlets, their speeches. John Locke doesn't show up half as much as Montesquieu, the French philosopher of the Enlightenment, the guy who basically invented the modern liberal state, built on toleration, justice, balanced with freedom, the belief in rational means of government. And also, by the way, Montesquieu is based very much on ancient Roman history. He wrote one whole book on the decline of the Republic, and his Spirit of Laws, his masterpiece, about one-third of it dwells on what the lessons are we can take from the Romans. That leads us to Scotland, because Montesquieu is hugely influential on the Scottish Enlightenment. And out of the Scottish Enlightenment come a bunch of philosophers, come a bunch of tutors who come to America and teach, among them John Wetherspoon, who becomes president of Princeton, and teaches young Madison about checks and balances. Out of the Scottish Enlightenment, by the way, also comes the Industrial Revolution. So it profoundly shapes our world. The Industrial Revolution begins with James Watt's steam engine, invented in Glasgow. They invent whole new fields of thought, sociology, demography, economics, modern history, all come out of the Scottish Enlightenment. By the way, the English Enlightenment totally skipped the universities. Oxford and Cambridge were dead in the water intellectually. The English Enlightenment happens more in technology, much more in new cities like Birmingham, than it does in the colleges.
You also write about James Madison as a kind of underappreciated, perhaps both president, but certainly founding father. In certain ways, he was small of stature. You said he was not a great writer, not a great orator, but he had a vision for the country that maybe still stands today.
Little Jimmy Madison, as they called him, fascinates me.
Ouch.
He's 5'1". He's maybe 110 pounds. He suffers from some form of epilepsy. He's not very social. But he does have a vision. And I think the role he plays is almost equal to that of Washington. That is, Washington wins the revolution, which was certainly not inevitable, and gives us the country. Madison comes along and figures out what that country should be. Madison didn't like the Articles of Confederation, a very weak central government with the governors basically trying to run each of the states by themselves, not unlike America under President Trump with the virus. The central government does nothing, and the governors try to each figure out something. So Madison looks at the Articles of Confederation and says there's got to be a better way. And he begins by spending 4 years reading ancient Greek history, Roman history, especially why did republics fail? Could you have a big republic? Montesquieu, very important figure, had said, no, republics are only small, only city-states. What kind of alliances were there between these city-states? And he studies the Lycian Confederacy, the Amphictyonic, if I get that right, Confederacy, which, by the way, is why each state has two senators, because the Amphictyonic League had two votes for city-states, whether they were big or small. It's kind of the NATO of the ancient Aegean region.
And we have that today, clearly, yes.
Yeah, so Madison comes along with all this study, and he beats the drum and campaigns for a constitutional convention. It happens, finally. He's the first guy to get there. He gives a big speech that lays out a lot of these ideas. A lot of them wind up in the Constitution, not all of them. He wanted, for example, to have a federal veto over state laws. He thought it was crucial. That never happened. They discuss at one point of the Constitutional Convention, should the presidency have three people or one person? And they look to ancient Roman history and say, that didn't work for the ancient Romans. They have arguments over, for example, should the Supreme Court impeach the president, or should the Congress? And they kind of decide some of these things in an afternoon, which is one reason I think We can go back and revisit some of those decisions. We can amend the Constitution, which they designed to be amended. Next, Madison goes to New York and leads the campaign to ratify the Constitution, which, again, was not inevitable. New York very narrowly voted to support it. Virginia supported it really only because Massachusetts already had, and it wanted to hold things together. And then, in his last great act, Madison, in the 1790s, plays the same role I think Washington did in the 1770s. Washington had the great insight to recognize the nature of the war he was fighting and to adjust his mode of fighting to fit that new perception, that new understanding. Likewise, Madison in the 1790s says, you know, we're going to have politics. We're going to have faction. Let's have political parties. And he and Jefferson form the opposition parties, set up newspapers to get the opposition views out, and basically create the first draft of the American two-party system. So again and again, Madison is the key thinker in the 1780s, 1790s about how to get this country up and running. Unfortunately, his presidency was no great shakes. Not much happened in the War of 1812. But, right. You know, he did a whole lot, and I think he should be more appreciated.
And that's Tom Ricks, our guest on Radio Times today. He's got a new book, First Principles, What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country. Tom, did they read about Spartacus and slave uprisings in these ancient times? And if they did, how? I mean, this is the kind of essential question for this country, is our lofty ideals and slavery and racism that we're seeing today?
They were terrified of slave uprisings. They may have read about Spartacus, but boy, they don't talk about him. Again, this modern tool we have, Founders Online, you can go and see that the only one of the founders, the four people we're talking about here, who ever mentioned Spartacus was John Adams. Again, the only one never to own a slave. And Jill Lepore and other academic historians have recently made the point that the American Revolution may well have been sparked by the colonials' fear, the Southern colonials' fear especially, that the British were moving toward abolitionism. And by the way, the Scots outlawed slavery in Scotland before the English ever did in England. So again, the Scots are out in front. They didn't know what to do about slavery. The first thing they wanted to do was hold the country together at the Constitutional Convention. And South Carolina and Georgia, the two delegations, made it clear that if you guys put a whiff of ending slavery, we're out of here right now. And that was worrisome, not because they were so powerful. South Carolina and Georgia were really just down at the southern end of the colonies. But because that, if they went their own way, that could give foreign powers a toehold on the continent. That could bring England or France or both back in. And so they wanted to hold the country together to keep England and France from meddling here and from getting involved in the United States and pulling them into wars or launching wars. So they wind up writing a constitution that puts slavery into the fundamental law of the land. Slavery is not a blot on the American fabric. It is woven into the American fabric. The Civil War tries to pull out some of that. Some of it's still there. 250, 270 years after the founding of this country, we are still dealing with slavery. We are still slowly pulling some of those threads, some of those strands out of the fabric of the country. But there are still people in this country who think the black Americans are second-class citizens. And unfortunately, some of those people are wearing police uniforms and treating black Americans like second-class citizens. So, yeah, the aspirations the founders had were great, but we still have not lived up to some of them. I think they would be embarrassed to see what a problem slavery and its consequences have been for this country. They'd also be surprised that we haven't amended the Constitution more to deal with things like that.
Well, there are aspirations and then there's reality. I mean, even back 250 years ago with slavery, I mean, you can aspire to all these ideals, but if you are supporting a system of cruelty and degradation and the destruction of individuals' sense of themselves and families, I mean, it is this stain, forever stain on this country.
Yeah. And I think they would say, well, do something about it. We wrote this thing to be amended. We did the best we could, given the flawed people we were in our own time. What are you doing about it now? We've sort of stopped amending the Constitution. We did a lot more of it in the early years of the country than we have in the last 50 to 80 years.
We've interviewed some historians recently, and one of the things they say is it's actually hard to end the Constitution, amend the Constitution, that it requires perhaps too much effort to try to make it a more modern document. Do you agree?
Yeah, it is difficult. One of my pet projects would be to change the allocation of senators. When they gave each state two senators, Virginia, the biggest state, was 12 times as big as the smallest state, Delaware. Now, California is, I think, about 50 times bigger than the smallest states like North Dakota and Wyoming. I'd like to see us consider whether we should reallocate it so that the biggest third states have three senators, the middle third have two, and the smallest third have one. Because right now you have this absurd situation where basically all the states west of the Mississippi, except Texas, if you put them together, they have a smaller population than California. Well, all those states west of the Mississippi that voted for Trump, except Texas, have a huge number of senators, which is a little bit ridiculous. People in Wyoming are hugely overrepresented in power in the U.S. Senate, and that's not a good thing.
And that's Tom Ricks, our guest on Radio Times. Today we're going to take another short break and get back to our conversation talking about his new book, First Principles. He's the winner of actually two Pulitzer Prizes, has been a guest on Radio Times over the years, and we're talking about his new book about how the founders of this country learned from Greek and Roman philosophers and literature, how that shaped our country. And I do want to talk more about what we can do, how we can make us a more perfect union. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I'm Marty Mosco.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Wayne, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And I'm talking with Tom Ricks, a journalist, military historian. He's written a number of books. He's got a new one, First Principles. He's also a columnist for the New York Times Book Review. Let me read a couple of comments and questions from our listeners, and I do want to talk about some of your ideas for how to make us a more perfect union. Here's a question from Stu. What would prevent the Constitutional Convention from doing worse things than what we already have? Tom?
Nothing. this is an American experiment. As George Washington said in his first inaugural, and as President Obama said just a few days ago, the question is, are we on track now? Can we get back on track? And so the test would be, does this move us towards a more perfect union, or is it fraught with danger? And you really don't know until you try it. But it's not a perfect machine. They knew that, and they had to amend it pretty quickly. The election of 1800 was incredibly screwy because of this, because of some problems in how they wrote the Constitution. So I think the first thing is there are changes we could make. But the other thing is you shouldn't just let the conservatives be the OG original interpreters and original interpretism of the Constitution. There are phrases in there that we've somehow lost that we need to recover. There's twice the Constitution refers to the common defense and general welfare in the preamble and then later. We talk about the common defense a lot. I know in my life, because I was a national security reporter, I've spent years thinking about it. But we don't talk about this general welfare. What does that mean? Well, among other things, it means the common good. It means things like the environment, education, and most pressingly this year, the public health. I think it's crazy to have a for-profit healthcare system. Healthcare is like charging people for air. People deserve clean air. People deserve public health. We're the only modern capitalist country that has gone overboard and had this huge, unwieldy, incredibly expensive, and not very efficient for-profit healthcare system. So there's a lot of things we should look at in light of the Constitution, and I think that light, that illumination, does help.
Well, and you also talk about, as you mentioned, climate, healthcare, our system of even infrastructure. I mean, what is the common good? Education, transportation. These are all sort of embedded in how a functional republic is supposed to work.
And instead, we have relied heavily, really since Reagan was president, on privatization and making the market the judge of all things. The market is good to run markets. It is not necessarily good to run morality. It is not good if someone dies because they can't afford health care. The market gets too much deference. We make the market a god nowadays. It is not a god. It is not really prominent in the Constitution at all. But conservatives have kind of driven it in that direction, partly because they have sort of wrapped their arms around the Constitution. I'm saying it's time for liberals and leftists to wrap their arms around the Constitution, too. Look at general welfare and hold up our society to that test. Is that good for the public? Frequently, it's not. And so I think we have a Supreme Court that too often has privileged the market and property over the public good, the general welfare. And I think that's unconstitutional.
You talk about waking up Congress. I mean, do you feel as if our House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate have been taking a back seat to what's been going on in this country, or that gridlock has just taken hold of the place and we can't seem to get anything done?
It's interesting because the founders and the framers, the people who wrote the Constitution, assumed that the Congress would be the most energetic branch of government. And instead, it has really been the third branch of government taking a back seat to actions by the Supreme Court and the presidency. I think they would like to see a more active Congress. And I think, again, they would point to campaign finance as the thing that has made Congress too often be a trapping of the system rather than the engine of the system. I'm not a huge Bernie Sanders fan, but I think he was absolutely correct when he said that these days Congress doesn't regulate Wall Street, Wall Street regulates Congress. And again, I take that back to the role of money in politics. Money has poisoned American politics, and I think because of lousy Supreme Court decisions that really violated the spirit of the Constitution.
Let me read a comment from Thomas related to that. He says, to silence corporate speech, it seems like you'd have to somehow give organizations of people fewer rights than individuals. How could that be done in a principled way? It seems like you have the right to do something individually. You should have the right to do that thing in concert and with others.
Sure. They have rights. I just don't think they have as many rights as people do. Corporations are not people. It's very hard to say this corporation killed somebody, let's put it in the electric chair. It's very hard to put a corporation in jail. At the same time, corporations, I think, should not have more influence over American politics than people do.
You talked about Adams, who jailed journalists. We have had other presidents. Our current president, even President Obama, was very critical of some journalists about this reclaiming the definition of what it is to be un-American. And that's a charge that can go right and can go left. But it does involve speech and what people say. How do we – this is something we have struggled with for, you know, centuries now. How do we reconcile this First Amendment issue?
I think we're fortunate in this country because we do have a written definition of what it means to be American. The Constitution is a lot of things. In some ways, it's a peace treaty between these states at the beginning of the country. It's a fundamental law of the land. In some ways, it's a strategy. But it also is definitional. So a congressman running for Congress who slugs a reporter is acting in an un-American way because he is violating the First Amendment. Likewise, a college campus, college students who prevent someone from speaking on the campus because they disagree with them is violating the Bill of Rights and acting in an unconstitutional, un-American way. And the great thing about this is we have this definition, and it's open to everyone. I think one of the astonishing things about this country is somebody who got off an airplane yesterday and is an American citizen as a one day has every right that someone who's been here for 200, whose family has been here for 200 years does. And all they have to do is follow the Constitution. I think we should educate people better, especially in the Bill of Rights, and talk about what that means. I was amazed in this little town I live in Maine that someone said he didn't like seeing those Obama signs up during the last eight years ago. So he was going around taking them down. And I said, you know, that's undemocratic. You can't have a democracy without an opposition running. You got to have some. I admire anybody who runs for office, Republican or Democrat or third party. To put yourself in the arena is, I think, a noble act, and we should appreciate it more. And again, appreciate people for their time, money, and contributions, volunteering more, and appreciate people for their donations less. I hate walking around America and seeing all these billionaires' names on every public, you know, park and building and so on. I've heard it referred to as billionaires' graffiti. And I just don't think it honors the wealthy people for being wealthy. If they paid their damn taxes, we wouldn't have to have them take care of the parks for us. They are not paying. The 1% is not. It's taking too much money out of society and not giving money back. And because money dominates politics, and since the Reagan era, the top 1% have withdrawn from public life while seeking to dominate public policy.
And I certainly agree with you about dissent and disagreement, but what do we do about something like QAnon or some of these more extreme forms of propaganda, of false and conspiracy theories that actually are potentially dangerous?
You've got to protect repugnant speech. Why? Because someone may decide tomorrow that your speech is repugnant. Mm-hmm. So what is the alternative? The alternative is to protect it, allow it to happen, and hope that this country, built on the belief that the free expression of ideas, that decency ultimately will prevail, that works. Thomas Jefferson addresses this in his first inaugural address, which is significant. It's the first time the opposition has taken power in this country. And he speaks to the people he's just beaten in the election, and he says, look, every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We can disagree without saying the other person's bad. The second thing he says is, as for the Federalist, let them have their say. If we're right that our views ultimately are better, they will prevail among the people. So I say, you know, let the QAnon speak, even let the KKK speak. Don't regulate speech. Hope that this reasonable, the sensibility of the American people, voter by voter, prevails. But in order for that to happen, you've got to have free, fair, and open elections in which people can vote and are confident their votes will be counted. And I see the attacks on people voting, trying to prevent them from voting, claiming their votes are false or fraudulent. I see those as really un-American and in violation of the spirit of the Constitution.
Let me read some more comments. One from Sean. He says, the founders intentionally structured the government so that less populous states would be overrepresented. This was to protect the rights of the minority. Ricks is suggesting we bend more towards a pure democracy, i.e. mob rule. And Sean says, not a good idea. What do you say, Tom Ricks?
I say you can correct a tendency without overcorrecting. What the founders did, I understand, give the small states some protection, but they are vastly more protected now than they were then by a factor of four.
Here's a comment from Harold. Many of the points Mr. Ricks is making are main points that Bernie Sanders continually makes. Why does he think there is such resistance in the Democratic Party to him and his ideas?
I think Sanders is a poor spokesman for his ideas.
In what way?
He grates. He's not particularly persuasive. He comes off like an old crank.
Like Adams?
Yeah, but also like Newt Gingrich, people who are built for opposition, people who have no idea what to do when they're actually in power. And I've never had any sense that Sanders would make a good president. Somebody who's a good critic is not necessarily a good leader.
You also talk, you also say, in fact, the first thing you say at the end of the book to your readers is don't panic. But I do sense panic across the land. Do you?
No, I don't. I think we just had an extraordinary election. I thought there would be violence in this election, and there was not. It appears to be, by all accounts, except the election deniers, it appears to have been a really well-run, well-secured election. So I think that's a good sign. The second thing is, while Donald Trump has been a disaster as a president, he has demonstrated the resiliency of the system. Where he failed frequently, where he stubbed his toes, was when he didn't understand the Constitution and was surprised to see the Supreme Court not follow him, was surprised when Nancy Pelosi said, I've actually got some individual powers here, in powers of this body, and we're not going to do X, Y, or Z. Where Trump really was destructive was with norms. What we expect, what the precedents that have been established. And that is one thing I think we could look at in a constitutional convention or a review of the Constitution, is what are things that have been norms that should be written into law? And this has happened before. For example, when an amendment was passed making two presidential terms the limit for a president. So we have seen norms written into law and made part of the Constitution. I think there may be other norms that we probably should think about. I was looking at a list of like 25 norms that Trump has violated, destroyed, or tainted. Some of those might need to be part of the Constitution.
We're almost out of time here, but what did the founders mean by happiness and by virtue? And you write a lot about virtue because they thought a lot about what a virtuous either government or person is.
They looked at virtue as key. They used the word more than they did freedom or liberty. The older generation, Washington especially, thought virtue was the essence of public life, acting more for the public good and for the common good than in one's self-interest. And what was the second part of that?
Having to do with happiness?
Oh, happiness. Happiness, especially in the way that Jefferson uses it at the beginning of the Declaration, is a sense of being prudent, just, wise, and avoiding pain, finding ways to lead a decent life. It was not a material definition of happiness that I think we have nowadays, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
We're going to leave it there. Something very modern. Tom Ricks, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And he is a journalist. He's a military historian. He's the author of several books, a number of books, I should say, including a new one, and it's titled First Principles, What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country. He's also a columnist for the New York Times Book Review. And we appreciate all those comments to Radio Times as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.